Thank you for listening to this Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. Now, before we get started, I just want to take a moment to thank Footman James for sponsoring Last Blast. As you know, at The Intercooler, we only partner with like-minded organisations, with companies that we think really understand what it means to be a car enthusiast. Footman James fit into that perfectly. I know this because when talking to them before making this recording, they said to me, please don't talk about car insurance, which I think says a lot. So instead, I'm just going to give you a couple of reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. Coffee and chrome, for one thing, that's Footman James' regular car meet. It's free to attend once you're registered, and it's where hundreds, if not a thousand, car enthusiasts get together with their classics to enjoy and share their passion for cars. Footman James also publishes its indicator report. It's a thorough analysis and a detailed report into the state of classic car ownership in this country. The point is to promote and safeguard the future of classic cars in the UK. So there you go, two good reasons why Footman James is different to other car insurance companies. So thank you, Footman James. Go and visit footmanjames.co.uk. You're listening to the Last Blast podcast by The Intercooler. This week, Andrew Frankel talks to racing driver and supercar development driver, Andy Wallace.
Well, hello everybody and welcome to another Last Blast podcast. Today you find me in the company of a man who's not only won Le Mans, he has won the Daytona 24 Hours three times, Sebring twice, and is in fact stood on more podiums at Sebring than anybody else in history. I am with Mr. Andy Wallace. Andy, welcome to the TI Last Blast podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, as you know, the first thing we have to do is a little bit of due diligence and find out what your first car was, what your first race was, and what your first crash was. So, please, enlighten me.
Yeah, they're definitely on my memory, all of those. My first car was a nasty old, on its last legs, Renault 16.
Oh.
You know, with the gear stick that came out
of
the ashtray.
Yeah, I love those.
Yeah, no, it was fantastic, but it was bought at auction for next to nothing, sort of, as seen.
And you were, like, 17 at the time?
Actually, I was 16. I sort of just went around the block a couple of times just before.
That's what does.
Yeah, just before. Didn't say that, but yeah. I had a drive shaft failure on it and lots of other things. But the one thing that I do remember, it doesn't make it a great car, by the way, but I had a couple of mates from school in the back of the car and one in the front. And we're coming down this hill and near Oxford, and it was actually near where I'd been to school. And at the bottom was a busy junction on a 90-degree corner. And as I got about halfway down the hill, I put my foot on the brake, and there's no brakes. Nothing.
Nothing.
So I said to the people in the car, you know, hey, guys, we haven't got any brakes. Yeah, that's funny. And really didn't have any brakes. And honestly, and I was pumping like crazy. Handbrake never worked. You pull it out of the ashtray, it's doing nothing, virtually nothing. What had actually happened was the metal brake pipe had been rubbing up and down, up and down, up and down the suspension and got a hole in the pipe. That was basically it. So, I mean, there weren't very good brakes in the first place, but with all the fluid coming out, even worse. So I just pumped like crazy, and I tried to go down gears, I did everything, and I could see at the bottom it was quite a busy road.
Oh my God.
And I just had to join it, and somehow I joined it, and everything was fine. It was an interference fit, you know.
Yeah.
I thought
this was going to lead into your first crash, but clearly not.
No, well, I saved up till later. So that was my... That was my first road car.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Renault 16. And I kept it for a while and eventually it blew up or did something. The first crash, on the other hand, was, and you might have to take some of this out because it's a relatively long story, but I'll leave it to you. But so I wanted to go racing and didn't have any money and went to the bank and said to them, right, can I borrow £1,000? And they said, okay, but what for? I said, because I'm going to buy a racing car. But don't worry, you'll get all the money back, so I'm going to be world champion.
That sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, it was a fantastic deal. It was when there was a bank manager, so he just basically just looked at me, did the spin round things, and all behind you, see ya. So I went out, and I thought, okay, that's not going to work, but I still need to buy a racing car. So I went to a place that sells second-hand cars, and I bought a car all on payments, and I sold the car the next day. So because there was nothing.
Oh, so you bought it on HP?
Yeah, that's it. And nothing to stop you doing it. There was no computer, nothing. So that's fine. Obviously, Karen paid the payments. It wasn't a problem, but somebody had bought a car that was not actually mine. So I didn't have quite the £1,000, but I had enough money in total to buy a race car.
Yeah.
Guy in Scotland was selling it, and he...
what was it?
It was a Hawkdale 11, Formula Ford 1600.
Yeah.
It was a 1973, so my idea was to join the pre-74 championship with this car.
Okay.
So, and this was 1979
okay.
when I bought the car.
Yeah.
So he came down from Scotland. We met in Sandbach Services near Alton Park, and he came in one of those... converted coaches that he used to have in the old days.
Yeah,
I think what did for them in the end was I think you couldn't get them insured, and that's why they disappeared. I have a feeling. But so you basically saw the back in down the middle, and you make some folding doors, and you put the car up on a ramp in the back, and in the front you've got enough seats to sit down, have a cup of tea, little kitchen and stuff. It was brilliant. So he gets this Formula Ford out. And so I thought, right, great, so I fire it up and I drive around Sandbach Services in a Formula Ford car. I'm just thinking, what could happen to you now if you did that? Anyway, I borrowed my dad's Austin Maxi and I bought a trailer for 50 quid off Jonathan Palmer.
Right.
And that's how I arrived at Sandbach Services. So I said, yeah, that's fantastic, wonderful. So we go into his coach, have a cup of tea, and I've got all £10 notes, and I count them all out. And when I get to, he wanted £1,250. I gave him the last one, £1,250. And I think he took pity on me, and he said, look, go and buy yourself some breakfast or something, and here's 10 quid back. You know, from a Scotsman, that's pretty good going. So no, I was really grateful, because I was starving hungry. And put this thing on the back of the trailer, and off we went, back home. This is leading to my first accident, by the way. I haven't forgotten the question. get the car home.
And I presume your first accident is before your first race?
Yeah, it's before the first race, yeah. So, and it wasn't in the Austin Maxi either. But I got the car at home, and I sort of did a bit of stripping down and rebuilding just to make sure I knew how it all worked. So I'd been to all of the races of the pre-74 up until this point and watched and took times, and so I knew roughly what you need to do to be on the front row. So booked a 35 quid Friday test session at Silverstone. It was a mixed test session. Couple of mates and my dad came and helped, brother as well. So did a few laps, came in, changed a few things, and before you know it, I was lapping in a front row time in the car. So, that's fantastic. Yeah. This is going to be easy. You know, what could possibly go wrong? Came in the pits. We made one more adjustment to the car. Went back out, and it was mighty.
Yeah.
Oh, this is it. We're cooking. So, coming down the club straight at Silverstone, you remember the old wood cut?
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Is what, 120 degree corner or something?
Yeah.
And then you have the start finish line.
Yeah.
So, it's a 3/4 mile straight. So, I'm halfway down the straight, and this clubman's car came up, got a tow from me, pulled out, passed me, pulled back in. This is on slicks and wings, but with a similar engine to Formula Ford.
Yeah.
Somehow, I guess it might have been more powerful because it passed me. And then as we get to Woodcourt, he puts the brakes on a little bit later than me. I don't have any slicks or wings. Then he turns into the corner and then he drops it. And I'm pretty close behind him.
Oh, he just rotates in front of
you. Yeah, he rotated. And I, with my lack of experience at that point, I had actually spun my car a couple of times. And when I spun it, it went far.
Yeah.
But of course, with the slicks and the wings, it doesn't. So as he spun, I thought, well, I'll just go inside him. It'll be fine between him and the apex. And it stopped so quickly when he spun. It kind of caught me, and I couldn't go behind him. So I had to just carry on with my plan to go, and it's not going to work. And so my left front wheel hit his right front wheel.
Right.
And it went upside down. Then it did 3 barrel rolls, finished upside down, scraping along the ground. And you never guess where it stopped. Pole position. On the start line. It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. Although at this point, I'm still panicking a bit because it had a breather pipe on. It was an aluminium fuel tank on these Formula Fords and a breather. And it's petrol pouring all over me. And I thought, well, I'd better get out. And I was frantically trying to get out, forgetting the one vital thing that you need to do, which is undo the seat belt.
Yeah.
And that's why I couldn't get out in the end. So this hand came in eventually under, and it was Silverstone Sid.
Oh, God.
And he clicked the seat belt, pop, out I come, and then he said to me, okay, stand there and don't move, because the track was still live. There was yellow flag.
They hadn't stopped the session.
Well, it was yellow flag, and they didn't... it's not like it is now. This was 1979, 31st of August 1979.
Right.
So it was, you know, I think it was optional, the yellow flagging things in those days.
And there's a bloke upside down in a car, and they're like, keep going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure there was a flag, but not many people were... Anyway, so I look... So I'm sort of on the inside of the track where pole position is. I look left towards Woodcote whilst I was standing and doing what I was told. And this red Van Diemen Formula 4 car comes round the corner, totally on opposite lock, full throttle, beautiful power slide. And it was Fernando Ribeiro.
Yes.
Which was the brother, I guess, of Alex Ribeiro, if you remember. And I don't know if you remember that Formula 4 car, but written on the side in big white letters is Jesus Saves. I just couldn't believe it. Anyway, he missed me. It was beautifully controlled power slide, but probably not appropriate for when the car was upside down. And it was all good. So at this point, having spent the money on the car and a bit
and you,
more,
you were unhurt?
Yeah, I was absolutely fine. It was just a bit of a mess, the car, and it was the first time out, and I spent all that money, and that's all. I didn't have it. I borrowed that money anyway. So it was all a bit of a mess. I remember my dad saying to me, this is a really stupid idea. Like, you know, we don't have any money. You don't have any money. If you carry on like this, you're just going to end up with, it's a disaster. Forget it, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, I didn't want to forget it. So it was about £1,000 to put it right, and I only paid £1,240 for it. So it was a mess. And so basically from that 31st of August 79, I had a couple of part-time jobs, and I was working for British Gas as a service engineer. When I left school, I did the apprenticeship, and so I was doing that, and I was doing washing dishes in universities in Oxford, anything I could do just to try and earn the money. And so it got all the way around from there to January before I got it back together. So that was because the chassis had to be straightened, and a bit where the roll hoop was scratched over, we put some weld over the top, filed it over and painted it. You couldn't tell. But I did learn a lot about the car, interestingly, because it was all in pieces. So I didn't really get a workshop manual or anything with it, and Haynes didn't do one for the Hawk DL11. So it all got back together, and... first race of the season for pre-74 in 1980 was Croft. So stuck it on the back of, by this time I think I bought a Ford Transit, an old Ford Transit Luton, I think it was at that point, and then I had the trailer on the back. I got rid of the Jonathan Palmer trailer. It had mini wheels from a Mini.
Right.
And I realised in the end they're absolutely useless because every 50 miles you get a puncture.
Yeah.
That's apparently what happens with these wheels. They're not designed for that. So I ended up with a four-wheel trailer, and... I got some electrical conduit over the top and put a tarpaulin over it, so you could actually change the gear ratios on the trailer if you needed, if it was pouring the rain, because it does that in England sometimes. Anyway, so get to Croft, and I've gone past my first accident, so you have to stop me. Basically.
Yeah. No, oh, yeah. But you're now at Croft, so you're now at your first race, aren't you?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So first race, and so we did a test session before. There was one in sort of the end of the week. It all was looking good. And I qualified in third position for my first ever race. So I was pretty chuffed at that.
Bet.
There's some experienced people in the race. So during the race, I got a little bit enthusiastic and I ended up dropping it. And I didn't hit anything, but spun. But I went to the back.
Yeah.
So then on my chase back to the front, I got fastest lap of the race and actually did finish third.
Bloody hell.
So yeah, so I was fairly chuffed. I thought, okay, this is going to be all right. Yeah. And then the second race was Donington Park, and on the short track at Donington Park. So had a really good race, and I was in the leading three, and we were swapping positions all the time, left, right, and centre. And then come the last lap, I think I was third, but the other two were directly in front of me. And
so you were going to have a go, weren't you?
Yeah, and I thought, you know, I can see, it's just round, it'd be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I completely and utterly misjudged it, and there's a concrete wall on the inside, and I managed to hit that. So
Your second crash,
yeah. So this is not going fantastically well. Anyway, fast forward slightly, and Cadwell Park was the fourth race.
Yeah.
And not an easy track to learn as a, you know, if somebody's not driven there before. There was a motorcycle event on the Saturday, and our race was on the Sunday. So we went, I think we did a test on the Thursday or Friday, and we just had a little tent that we're sleeping in the morning. I poked my head out of the tent. The whole paddock is full of bikes. And my car was on the trailer, and all the bikers going past, going, oh, that side car's got too many wheels, and things like that. But I watched the bikes, and I actually learned quite a lot watching the bikes. I saw where they were falling off, and, and okay, right, so I got that in my mind. And, yeah, I won the race. So that was my fourth ever race. There were 12 that year, and I won six of the 12 and won the championship. So it started off badly.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes you have to do a couple of things to realise that, A, you don't
you've got to fail
know
to
what
succeed,
you're doing.
Haven't you?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
So that was how it went. And I was really chuffed, but in the end of the year, actually, I sold the car for twice what I paid for it, which didn't make up for all the damage I'd done during the year, but at least it...
You paid off some of the HP.
Yeah, it did.
So you know what you're here for. You're here to tell us your six favourite cars, and at the end of it, you can tell us which one you'd have your last drive in. So could we have the first of them?
Right, the first one. So this is, again, you know, trying to get somewhere in motor racing, and I had some really great people trying to help me find bits and pieces here and there. But I never really had any money. I had a nasty old, what was it, Austin 1100 and all these kind of nasty things. But the Renault, the first car, the Renault 16 and stuff. So the first time I ever had a proper car was when I got into Formula 3.
Yeah.
We were using Volkswagen engines.
Yeah.
And part of the deal was you were loaned a Golf GTI. It was a Mark II.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, Mark II Golf GTI. What an amazing car.
It was.
I mean...
8-valve.
Yeah, I had the 8-valve.
Yeah.
The 16-valve came along later, not much later, probably the following year. But actually, for the second year, I still had another 8-valve. I never did have a 16-valve. But I couldn't believe it, because I'd had rubbish cars up until that point.
Yeah.
And this was just... And I thought it felt so fast. 112 horsepower. And I think it was 850 kilos or something. But it felt really fast. Yeah.
But also, compared to the stuff you're so well built and refined and
beautiful.
Nice to use. And
yeah.
They were great things, weren't they?
Fantastic golf ball for the gear lever. And, it was great. And we did lots of... I remember one of the times when... And actually, you only had it for, I think it was 9,000 miles. And if you got to that, they switched it for another one.
Yeah.
So I did have one GTR. And the very first thing we had to do was go to Vallelunga for a test. So I just... I left Oxford, and I just drove. I picked it up almost from VW, and then drove straight to Vallelunga, and I did the oil change myself in the paddock at Vallelunga, and absolutely fantastic. So that I keep thinking to myself, oh, it'd be fantastic if I could find another Mark II. But then on the other hand, so many people have told me, be careful, because when you drive it the next time, you'll find it's actually just a bag of bolts. You know, they weren't very good. It's just that they were as good as they were then.
It depends. So, I used to have a 205 GTI, which I loved, and then quite recently I got another one, and I still loved it. But there have been other cars which I've had or driven, and I've driven 30 years later, and I just thought, it's just a slow old, you know.
Yeah.
So I'd definitely go and have a go at one, see what you think.
I really would. And the 205 GTI, I remember... very well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And they were the ones with the lift off oversteer.
Oh, did they?
Which is,
absolutely. Yeah.
There were some fantastic cars back then, because cars didn't have to fit the mould much.
And they weighed nothing, as you say.
They weighed nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you won the pre-74 Formula Ford Championship, and then you did some 2000s?
Well, see, that causes a problem if you win it. So then you can't do it again. There's no benefit from doing it again. So I had to move to contemporary Ford. And then again, with everybody trying to chip in and help, and we ended up managing to buy a Royal RP26, I think it was. Yeah, Royal RP26. And then that started my first year of contemporary Formula Ford. It took a while, because the trouble is that, I mean, Formula 3 was just ridiculously expensive.
Yeah. And you're not someone who, you know, was born with any cutlery in your mouth at all.
Just, you know, it was impossible. And really, what I kind of feel sad in a way now is, if anybody tried to do the same thing again, you just can't do it.
No.
Because, you know, unless you've got the best of everything, you couldn't possibly show how good you were. And even if you did, what then what? You still need money to get to the next level.
Yeah.
So I guess, yeah, I came second in the Formula Ford Festival in 83, which was pretty cool, and won some races here and there, and never actually won a championship. Came close, but the festival I remember really well. By this time I had a Reynard, it would have been an 83, wouldn't it? Yeah, FF83. And a minister had loaned me engines then, and it had got to the point in Formula Ford where, because they weren't very powerful, I think somewhere between, I don't know, 103 and 108 horsepower or something.
Yeah.
And remember there was that famous engine called Patch. Do you ever remember that? So it won, I think it won probably half a dozen Formula Ford festivals. And it was, I remember talking to them about this. So what they did, they bought X amount of short engines from Ford Minister. And I think all the manufacturers did the same thing. And then they matched everything to get the best.
Yeah.
So I think if they bought 100 engines, they probably made 30 that were really, really good.
Yeah,
well, this particular engine, Patch, wasn't called Patch in the beginning. I think you know where this is going.
Yeah.
It just seemed to be a really good engine, and whoever they gave it to, it did really well. Well, eventually it blew up on the dyno and put a rod through inside. So they literally stuck a patch on it, rebuilt it, and it was still a good engine.
Still when I kept winning.
Yeah, so it was causing some trouble, really, because everybody wanted that engine. And it was probably like half a horsepower more or something.
Yeah, but you know,
it made a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I in 83, a minister, it was a minister engine patch. So in 83, I had son of Patch. And Andrew Gilbert Scott won the race with Patch, and I came second with son of Patch. But, and I'm sure his engine was the same. What made a lot of difference to Formula Fords was lapping the valves in.
Right.
To get absolutely most compression and everything. So I got really good at it here. You know, you get the water and oil out and everything, and you take the head off and you scrape the gasket off, making sure it doesn't go down the oil well and all the rest of it, and then lap the valves in. So what used to happen to the top runners in Formula Ford at the festival, each engine came with two heads. So you'd already have one pre-lapped in.
Yeah.
So when you finished the heat, you brought it back to the paddock and you just switched to the head that was already done, bolted it all back together, and it's ready to go for the quarterfinal. Excuse me. And then if you got any time left, you start lapping the valves on the one that you've just taken off, get that prepared.
And bang it back in again.
Yeah, so quarterfinal with that head, then you switch it again back for the semifinal, again back for the final. And that was, to get a result, that's what you needed to do. So it's very competitive.
Unbelievably competitive.
It's ridiculous how competitive. And it was such a fantastic time. And you didn't think anything of it. This was normal. And so, you know, the last call out of the paddock to the grid, you're still covered in oil. So you're going to wash your hands and everything and jump in. And off you go.
So when were you first sort of... So you found your way to Formula 3 in 85?
85 was the first year, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was with a lot of help from a lot of people and not really a full budget and... Same as always. I drove for Swallow Racing. So a guy called Tim Stakes was the boss of the team, and he was kind enough to help out. And I had a guy called Phil Fluke who my dad had worked for him. He was he was a publisher and a book binder and all sorts of things. So my dad just worked for him, and I think after chewing his ear off enough, he could help me a little bit for Formula Ford. But when he got to Formula 3, it was well out of his league.
Yeah.
But he had a couple of friends who, one owned an insurance company, and you know, so bit by bit, together with Tim Stakes and Swallow Racing, they managed to put together sort of enough to get going. And so that was 85.
And what that stage, what was the big pick? What was the goal? Was it Formula 1 world champion?
At that point, still sort of following that dream. You know, if you can.
So you haven't thought about sports car racing or anything like that by that stage?
No, exactly. And it was quite, you know, it was really, really tricky because, actually, Reynard, were we in Reynard? Yeah, it was still a Reynard in that year, yeah. So, and Adrian Reynard helped out a lot. Reynard Racing Cars helped out with a loan car and things like this. So it was lots of things, and Volkswagen, we managed to get an engine loaned as well. So it was. There were so many things coming together to try and help this.
Yeah.
And so, but you know, if you didn't perform or it didn't work, it just was going to go badly wrong, and you've got nothing at the end of it. But you don't think about that, do you? You don't worry about it because you're aiming for the big prize. So, what had actually happened is the Reynard was a carbon monocoque, which was old hat in Formula One by then, but it was fairly well. It was the first Formula 3 car that was carbon fibre. So, what had actually happened was we had a couple of failures on the car, a couple of times rear pushrod broke, and I had one break in practice, I think it was, at Brands Hatch, so coming towards Paddock Hill Bend, when there were catch fence poles and things, and just as you lift off to put the brake on, the pushrod snapped, and it sat down at the back and just fired itself into the catch fence poles, and a pole went into the monocoque and made a small hole in the monocoque. So, and at that point, I think I'd won probably three races up until that point. And we're right at the front of the championship with Maurizio Guzman was my sort of closest rival, I guess. So they just basically used filler, patched it up, put it back together. And then the next two or three races, all I could do was qualify on the back row or one row from the back. I just couldn't, the car was undrivable. And I remember doing the British Grand Prix support at Silverstone. And it was a disaster. I mean, I think I might have finished 13th or something. It was an absolute disaster. And the guys are going, what are you doing? What's wrong with you? I said, listen, this car is absolutely undrivable. And Adrian Maynard came down to have a look at what's going on. And he got his 2P out and he was tapping the monocoque. And he's like, yeah, it's all delaminated. It's totally
ruined.
Yeah. So I don't know how it got paid for or who, or whether it was another loan chassis or what. Something great happened and we ended up with another chassis to replace it. And straight after that, bang, front row every time again. But by which time the damage was done for the championship. Yeah. So I lined up at Silverstone Grand Prix circuit for the last race. I was 1 point behind Maurizio Guzman. He was on pole position. I was second.
Yeah.
We were running a spool for a Silverstone Grand Prix, you know, no diff.
Yeah.
And if you did that, you were flat through club corner and nearly flat through Stowe. It was also better off the start line.
Yeah.
So basically, but you had more understeer in the slow corner. So, but you had to get ahead. If you got ahead and you got through those two fast corners,
you're gone.
They never catch you. So I lined my car up. I sort of did a Max Verstappen and lined it across towards Guzman. And as soon as the light went on, I got a mega start.
Yeah.
And I was already a crossover next to him, but slightly ahead of him.
Yeah.
And I missed the shift to second.
Oh.
Like an idiot. So he got around the first corner. First, I was second. So he won, I was second. He won the championship.
Yeah.
So that was that. So then, more negotiation with no money. And it was just a disaster. And Robert Singh from Maverick Motorsport came in and was really, really helpful. I mean, he did a lot. And he was a bit of a wheeler dealer anyway, still is. And he managed to get a little bit from here and a little bit from there. And my guy was helping. And I think a full budget for 86 was maybe £130,000-£140,000. And in total, I think we managed about 50.
Right.
So, and Race for Britain, Steve Sydenham from Race for Britain also contributed some as well. And that, I think at one point we were about to stop, and without the Race for Britain money, we would have stopped. And that pushed it on. And then that year, I think we won, is it 12 races or something out of the 20? And plus the non-championship race, I think, was the Silverstone, the Grand Prix support race at Brands Hatch, won that. So, yeah, it was a lot of races and won the championship. So, kind of that. But that gets you into another situation. So, okay, so you've won the championship, which means you really can't do it again. There's no benefit. So yeah. Now you have to move up to
okay, just before we
next.
Do that, let's have another one of your favourite cars.
Right. Okie dokie. So, I'm going to choose... It's not kind of in chronological order.
Doesn't have to be.
But I guess it doesn't need to be, no. So I would say the next car that I had an amazing drive in was Cayman, Porsche Cayman.
Yeah.
In Wales, on some of those wonderful twisty roads. Yeah. I was doing a thing for Evo magazine. And I just I had to drive the car from here to there. And by the time I got there, I thought, I just need one of these cars. They're amazing. Not massively powerful. I think this was a... I don't remember because it was quite a while ago. Would it have been a Cayman R?
Yeah, I was thinking in my head, but it was a Cayman R. Yeah. It was a while back. Yeah, they were the absolute business.
Unbelievable. I think it was 340 horsepower from memory.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, so I think, and they were deliberately keeping the power level down so as not to,
so not to go for well, but yeah, absolutely.
But what a car. I mean, so fantastically balanced and everything. So I never had enough money to buy one, but at that point, but I kept getting out of the car and stopping and just sort of walking around it and then getting back in, you know, just to sort of try and suck more of it in. It was such a fantastic handling car.
Yeah, and so usable at the same time. You could see yourself doing that every day, couldn't you?
Yeah, really could. It is just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So that's number two.
So you've won the British Formula 3 Championship.
Yes.
And so the next logical step would probably be what, a 3000 or F1 from there?
Yeah, and 3000 was... Didn't 3000 start in 87? Wasn't it F2 before then? Or did it start 85? I can't remember. But yes, it would have been something like that.
Yeah.
But, see, and still up until this point, I was... I was racing, but I wasn't actually earning anything from racing in Formula 3 at that point. So then the end of year Macau Grand Prix, I had done it in 85, didn't go massively well. That was with the Swallow car.
Is that an amazing circuit?
It's an amazing, absolutely amazing track. Yeah. And it's so the fastest part of the track, the start line's moved, I think, one corner before, but it used to go off, set off, and it's a very, very fast, very wide, bumpy, and it's the only place where I think the highest top gear we used anywhere was a 25, 26 gear, and in Macau it was the other way around. It was an overdrive. It was a 26, 25. Yeah. That's how tall it was. And I think you could just go just over 160 miles an hour in an F3. That was a lot.
Blimey,
so you're going along, and it's really, really wide. And then at the end of the straight, you've got the Lisboa corner, which it just suddenly, it's a side street, and it's just really narrow. So you come in barreling down, there's room for everybody, and then you
room for no one.
Yeah, room for no one. And then it's a lot of concrete walls, and there's a lot of camber changes. It's a very, very difficult track, but really, really satisfying to get it right.
Yeah.
So I went down there, and we were sponsored by Watson's down there, and which is a big Hong Kong company. And I think they'd sponsored quite a number of cars. Anyway, it was, you got all your top competitors from the German Championship, French, Benelux, Japanese, US, UK Championships. There's a lot of cars down there. However, it probably favoured the British in some way, because we were running cross-ply tyres in the British F3, Avons, and they ran on cross-ply, I think it was Yokohama, down there. So a lot of the other series around the world had switched to radials at that point.
Right.
So it was quite a change of driving style and setup.
Yeah.
So I'm just, trying to explain why perhaps we got there. The car, as soon as we put the car on the road, it was fantastic. I got the track all sorted, and we ended up qualifying on the front. I believe I might have qualified second behind Stefano Modena. And there was a lot of guest drivers also in history. You've had F1 drivers coming down to do it. And this time, so Jan Lammers was there from F1 and sports car racing.
Yeah.
Quite a number of other really good drivers were there. So I can't remember exactly how the race, it's basically two 45 minute races put together, because you can't do an hour and a half and a fuel tank in a Formula 3 car. But the first heat, it ended up having this massive dice with Jan Lammers.
Yeah.
And I don't know how he got ahead of me. Maybe it was at the start, but so he was leading, and I'd never really spoken to him before, so I knew who he was, and I was kind of all over him, and lap after lap, and he just was placing his car perfectly, and he wasn't making any mistakes, and I thought, I need to win. So, last lap, so the last real place to overtake is going into this Lisboa corner. So Jan's going down the straight, he's looking at me, he can see where I am, and he's making his car quite wide. And I think, still to this day, he's the driver with the best car control of anybody I've ever met. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's a side story, but he was an instructor from age 14 at the Slottermarker School
at
Zandvoort. So he really, really brilliant.
Yeah.
So he's like, and bearing in mind too, he's the guest driver, so he's not done Formula 3 all year. So it was an unfair fight in some way, but so I'm all over him, and he just broke so late, and he almost got away with it, but he locked up the rear, and the car sort of moved a little bit sideways, and he touched the white line with his left, and then it went around, and the apex of this Lisboa corner is a barrier, like a triple high barrier, called a steel barrier. So he's now he's not going to spin the car. He's kind of got it under control, but there's nowhere to go. And he's going to hit the barrier on the inside. So I saw my chance, and I dived down the inside of him. And just as he's going to hit the barrier, I bumped front wheels, back wheels, front wheels, knocked him straight and passed him. So now we're still at racing speed, but I'm in front of him. It was brilliant. You couldn't do it again if you tried. And, you can find this on YouTube. And I found it. But then once I found it, I could never find it again, because it's in a group of about 60 videos. And you've got to go through all of them until you find the bit. But
it's there.
Yeah, it's there.
And you won.
And then so I won. And then I ended up winning the second heat as well. I think I cleared off in the second heat and nobody bothered me. But so we're on the podium together. And then Jan's like, oh, that was brilliant. He said, thanks for that. He said, I was definitely going in the wall. And we had a nice chat. And we got on really well. And then sort of after the event, I mean, I went round to all the F1 teams and I was knocking on the doors. I've won the Macau Grand Prix and I've won the Formula 3 Championship. Yeah, yeah, we know you are, we know you are. So two teams, Tyrrell and Arrows, offered me a deal, and it was I had to find $600,000. There was absolutely no way. So at this point,
But if you'd been in a position to write the check, you'd have been a Formula 1 driver.
Yeah, well, yeah, and yeah. Actually, Julian Bailey, yes, and Julian Bailey, actually, he took the Tyrrell drive in the end, was he? I think it was teammate to Jonathan Palmer, maybe.
That's
that
about
year.
Right, yeah.
I think it was about right. So and Julian owned a pub,
yes,
which was mortgaged, so he sold the pub, I think, to get some of the money, and a friend of his loaned him another to get the 600,000. And that's how we did it. And then it turned out that actually the car wasn't very good that year. So it didn't do very well. So I don't know if it would have been, you know, if I'd have managed somehow to borrow the money, it would have been a sort of in and out and done.
Yeah.
Which is a shame because Julian was a fantastic driver.
Sure.
And it's just a shame that that's how it went. So it kind of went a bit wrong. In the interest of making this story not too long, so there's a bit in the middle that's kind of different. But I did get a call from TWR. And they were looking for one extra driver for Le Mans for 1988, and because they were running five cars, and they had a lot of fantastic guys, a lot of experience, and they're just trying to get one more. And Jan Lammers, when he got back, he put my name in the hat because he knew they were going to do a test at Paul Ricard and look at a few drivers. So I get a call and say, okay, if you're interested, come to Paul Ricard and we'll run you in the car, which is really nice of Jan. But then when I get there, Jan's like, okay, so if they're interested in you, they're going to put you with us in the car with Johnny Dumfries and me.
Yeah.
So it's in my interest to make sure you know what you're doing. So, and he took me to one side and he said, listen, this is not a Formula 3 car. It's going to be a bit alien to you in the beginning. So I'd never driven a closed car. It's hot inside.
Tell me, how much power would a Formula 3 car have?
165.
And this had 700?
700 and something, yeah.
And full ground effect bodywork.
Full ground effect, 900 kilos.
As opposed
speed.
To Formula 3 car,
455.
So twice the weight, five times the power.
Yeah, it's mad. And then on the straight, it would do about 205 on the straight, I remember from memory. And but Jan kept saying to me, look, it's going to weave about on the straight.
Because you had Le Mans bodywork on it.
Le Mans bodywork, yeah. And also because of the straights, we were with Dunlop and they were using radials for the whole year. But for Le Mans, they had to go back to crossplies because the radials couldn't go as fast as the car could go. So we're on the crossplies. Okay. And so it was also moving around. And he said, look, just pretend you're towing a caravan in a crosswind. So just let it do its thing. You'll be okay. And he really, really helped me so much. And so at the end of it, they had a car in sprint spec with all the big wing and then the car in the low downforce. And they predominantly put me in the low downforce one just to get acclimatised to it. And in the end, actually, the times I did were pretty good. It was pretty close to the regular driver. So I think they straight away thought, oh, this is not too bad. But then they thought, well, but he's a Formula 3 driver, so maybe it's not going to be good for him for... You know, is he strong enough, fit enough? So they said, right, okay, we like it so far. We're going to put you in the car for an hour now and see what you can do. So I strapped myself in and everything, da, 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 da. Set of tyres goes on, fuel nozzle off, see ya. So I'm going round, and honestly, that car, there's no power steering. There's the brake pedal is so, so hard.
Yeah.
And just... And ground effects
and big downforce.
Big downforce, yeah. So, you know, somewhere like a seam corner, by the time you get there, even in low downforce trim, it's got, just so much downforce, this thing.
And hot, presumably, down.
Yeah, hot, and there's no, you know, the air that's coming in is warm. It's a front radiator, so, you know, it's really, really hot. But I knew what I had to do, so I just kept going and kept going and kept going and kept going. And the last, like, three or four laps, my head was falling off, and I made it back to the pits, and I thought... That wasn't too bad. Times were pretty close throughout. And I got the door open. I thought, oh, blimey. I was thinking, goodness, that's over. They went, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I did it. No. You'd be doing double stints at them also.
Oh, shit.
They put the nozzle back on.
And off you went.
And I went again. And I was like, oh, and I wouldn't have even been able to stand up if I got out of the car. You know, and my head was just lolling about everywhere by this point. I thought, no, it's impossible. So anyway, I thought, well, I've got to do it. So,
of course.
I did the second hour, obviously not as good as the first hour, but I was, they didn't have to get me out of the car, they just pulled the bung out of the block, I just drained out the bottom in the end. But it was good enough that, and I hadn't made any mistakes or anything like that. And with Jan and Johnny's help, you know, I mean, everything they taught me was just absolutely spot on, which for a single-seater driver, you have to be very, very selfish and you don't share anything with anyone.
Yeah.
So to suddenly get thrown into this situation where you will never win a race if the three of you don't work together,
yeah,
it was really an eye-opener. And I had a lot of trust with those guys, and it turned out to be absolutely right. So I get a call, okay, come to Tom Walkinshaw's office in Kidlington next morning. So I'll go in his office, sit down with him. He's right, okay, well, you did a good job, and thank you, Mr. Walker. Right, so we want to put you in the car for Le Mans. Right, and I've been three times went on a Page and Moy coach trip with my dad, you know, yeah. when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
But I knew the race really well. And he said, right, so this is what we want, and this is what we'll pay you for each event. So this much for Le Mans, this much, and we can't put you in Le Mans as your first race. It's not going to work out. So we're going to send you to Jerez for the first race in the World Sports Car Championship. We're going to send you to Road Atlanta for the IMSA race, and then you're going to do a load of testing, and then you can do Le Mans. And this is what we'll pay you for all these different things. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. Oh, I love that. That's brilliant. So off we go. And
just give us another one of your favourite cars.
Right, so number
three.
Be careful, so yeah, number three. I'm going to say number three, which is kind of going to spoil that story slightly because that's where I went after the Jaguar thing. But when Group C changed from 900 kilos and any engine you wanted on a fuel consumption formula, it went to Formula One engine, 3.5 litre V10s,
yeah,
and it went down to 750 kilos.
I know what you're going to say. Yeah,
the TSO10 is the first one I drove. Honestly, the performance of that car was absolutely beyond anything I'd ever experienced in my life. So only 750 kilos, but they probably found another 10 or 20% more downforce from the Granifex since the previous year.
Yeah.
3.5 litre V10s, not much torque, razor sharp throttle response, also not that much horsepower, but it didn't matter because you were lighter and you had a lot of downforce. And honestly, you had to reappraise every corner you thought you knew. It was at least a gear higher when you got there. And it's an incredible performance. And I just remember, absolutely honestly, driving, if you drove 10 laps in that car, you couldn't breathe anymore. Not just because your lungs and everything was squashed in the in the corners. And I'm sure the F1 guys are having the same problem now. But so you really had to train yourself to breathe, even though you didn't really need to at that point. Just keep breathing, keep breathing, keep breathing. Because when you get to the corner, you won't be able to. And you might be in the corner like 2 seconds, 3 seconds or whatever.
Shit.
And you can't breathe. So eventually, after about 10 laps during the practice sessions, you're completely out of breath. And there were occasions when I thought, shit, I'm going to have to stop. But you can't stop and say I'm out of breath. So you'd have to make up a reason for stopping, you know. And when you come in, I'm sorry, I've got a bit too much understeer, and then you make an adjustment to go back out. And obviously, I had to work really hard on the fitness. I put an exercise bike here in a sauna, and I was working on that, and I was doing lots of things for my neck. And
there's a story I can remember you telling me. I may be mistaken in this, and if I am, we'll just cut it out. But did you actually do something like break a collarbone or something in testing one of those things, just through bone fatigue, not because you hit anything?
No.
What happened?
So TSO10 again, Toyota sent two cars to Eastern Creek in Australia, the track there, fantastic track actually. So we wanted to do extended endurance tests with one car and performance testing with the second one. So I got the short straw with a couple of other guys. It was Kenny Acheson and Hitoshi Ogawa, I think. And we were driving the endurance car.
Yeah.
We weren't allowed for noise reasons to test all night. So it was 9 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night, 9 days straight.
Oh my God.
It was crazy. This clip is on YouTube, and every time, last night, this talk I did last night, they played it on a big screen with the noise full on, and it's incredible. But you see this TSO10 coming towards you, going through the gears, and you get to about 310 km, that's what, 119 miles an hour, I guess, 119 a bit miles an hour. And then you arrive at the first corner, which is essentially a 90 degree left hand corner, but it's quite a large radius and it's completely flat out.
Yeah.
So you hear this thing full on, no lifting, it goes into the corner, and then in the middle of the corner you hear as it goes over the bump. And basically it's lifting up and it's just moving over slightly because it lost grip, and then it's reattaching. bam, 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 through the corner. No lifting, no nothing. Well, if you do that for 9 days straight, I can attest that on the morning of the ninth day, over the bump, you're going to break two ribs, which is what happened. So, but we'd been doing this for the whole week. And so Kenny Atterson, Hitoshi Ogawa, it might have been Pierre-Henri Raffinat as well, might have been, because I think we might have had more drivers, but not 100% sure. But this was not quite at the end of my first, we were doing double stints. So I kind of carried on.
Did you know what you'd done?
Yeah, oh yeah, I felt it crack and it was horrible. But I thought, well, I can't let the side down and maybe it might be too bad, you know, it's a stupid thing to say. So I actually came in and refueled the car again to do my second stint. So I didn't put more work on the other guys. And I couldn't do the second stint, it was hurting so badly. So I stopped and I radioed and I told them. So they stuck the next guy in, which is Hitoshi Ogawa. He went out, he did about 10 laps, went over the bump and he broke two ribs as well. So I remember the Toyota guys, the Japanese guys were like, ah, they were very happy. Ah, car is stronger than driver. And they were really, really happy.
You'd broken it hadn't.
Yeah, because the car was bulletproof. It was absolutely fantastic. What a great car. But that corner was amazing. You just, it was brilliant. Except that was 29th of February 1992.
Right.
So Sebring is usually around 20, 21. So I guess that was a Sunday, I think, 29th of February. You can check that out. So Sebring is on a Saturday, so it would have been 20th of March. So 20 days later. But you start testing at Sebring on the Monday.
And you have broken ribs.
And I got broken ribs. So you're talking 15 days from that moment on. So first thing you got to do is you've got to fly back to Heathrow, because I wasn't going straight to Sebring. So on the flight back to Heathrow, you know, when you're in the plane and you're going to pass somebody in the aisle, in the toilet or whatever, I would wait. And when the guy was coming towards me, I'd say, like, okay, stop, 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 stop. Now listen, when you pass me, don't you dare touch me, okay? So it's just weirdo, you know. And I just made sure that, because honestly, I've done it.
It hurts.
And sneezing.
Yeah.
The only way is to just shoot everything out so there's all snot on the wall. So stop blowing up your rib cage. Anyway, so that was that. And then I thought, well, the luck of the thing was I was driving for Tom's Toyota in the World Championship.
Yeah.
But I was driving for Dan Gurney's All-American Racers in the US. So actually, they didn't need to know. So I thought, well, I'm not going to tell them, because if I tell them I've broken my ribs, they're going to replace me. Because I was doing Sebring with two drivers, with Juan Fangio second. And it's the bumpiest track in the world.
Yeah.
That Eagle car, so 900 kilos, probably 900 horsepower, four-cylinder, 2.1 litres, massive turbocharger, massive lag, monster springs, because it's full ground effect, big wings. And so it was going to hurt, for sure. But I thought, if I tell him, that's the end of that. So I said nothing. I went to the doctor and he said, oh, no, it's going to take you, 5 to 7 weeks, and there's nothing we can do. So I managed to get some fairly good painkillers and not say anything to anyone. And actually, with the adrenaline flowing, because we were doing well in the race all along, the adrenaline flow was okay. And the only time that I really felt it was hurting like crazy was when I was pulling the safety car any time. Because first of all, those cars are really stiff.
Yeah.
They're talking about 2,000 or 3,000 pound springs on these things to keep them off the ground because of the downforce.
Sure.
And over the bumps, it's really, but the other thing, behind a safety car, you can loosen the seatbelt and get your ribs away. I made a seat that was nowhere near my ribs.
Yeah.
We managed to do it. So, and then we won the race. So, so that was that story. But yeah, and that car.
Right. So let's spool back a little bit. Years.
So so they sent me to Jerez for the first race, which was, I think, a 480 kilometer race.
It was.
And I was teamed up with they to give me an easier ride, they put me with John Nielsen and John Watson, I think. So I was a third driver in the car, whereas normally you do it with two. Again, just to sort of break me in gently. And when it was my stint, and we were doing really, really well, we were in the top three for the whole race. And during my stint, at Jerez, there are two very, very fast right-hand corners before the last one onto the pit straight. It's the one where Martin Donnelly hit the wall and the car exploded. But you certainly in those days, you couldn't see around the corner. There's a concrete wall. And so I arrive, it's flat out. absolutely flat out. So I arrive in the Jag, no power steering, and all this downforce through the corner. And as I turned in, I realised, oh no, the C2 car just spun in front of me. And I, for the life of me, I wish I could remember who it was, because he's a really nice guy, and I can't remember his name now. I could basically see the whites of his eyes, because I was going to hit him right head on, and I'd have killed him for sure. And this time I chose the right side, and I managed to go round the back of him on the grass, a very, very dry grass, luckily. And I went round the back of him on the grass, and I missed him somehow. But I knew the car was all full of grass, the radiator full of grass, so I had to stop. So I get on the radio, pit, 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 grass on the radiator. So I pull up to the pit, and nobody's got any of the radio message, and I stopped in the pit, and they're on the pit wall looking at me, why is he here? And then they're all running off, and then they saw, and they cleaned the stuff out, and we went back out and we finished second, and I think we lost by 10 seconds or something to Schlesser in the Mercedes. So Tom was not best pleased, because I was in the car when it went wrong, and I guess he hadn't actually known exactly what went wrong. So he was definitely not best pleased, and I could tell that, and I thought, well, I better kind of keep away from him. And then the guy who was driving the car came up to me in the paddock and he said, listen, I have no idea how you A, didn't hit me, and B, didn't kill me. And he said, I owe you big time, because I just saw you appear, and there's nothing you could have done to miss me. If there's anything I can ever do for you. And I said, well, there is one
go
thing.
Tom.
Yeah, I said, Tom's in that caravan. Can you just tell him what you just said? Because I think he's really mad with me. So I kind of, out of sight but in earshot, he's knocking on the door, and Tom comes to the door. Ah, what do you want, laddie? And he said, Mr. Walker, I'm really sorry, I just want to say that I'm probably responsible for you not winning the race, but your driver did a masterful piece of accident avoidance, which I have no idea how he did it, and honestly anybody else would have hit me, so don't be too mad on him. And then Tom said to him, ah, if I was mad with him, he'd know it by now, he said. Then he shut the door. And I guess he wasn't mad with me, because I didn't get fired on the spot.
Yeah.
So that was that. And then the second race was, I think, Road Atlanta. Again, we were on the podium, but we didn't win. And then the third race was Le Mans. So Le Mans 24 hours.
So let's just have a quick look at that race. Your first ever Le Mans.
No test day that year.
No test day that year. So the first time you saw the track was in quali.
Well,
or will practice.
Jan and Johnny, I think all the sessions counted in those days, so they were all timed. But Jan and Johnny said, right, come with us, we'll show you something. So get in the car, we drive around. Then we also, we got bicycles, we bicycled around.
Yeah.
A lot of the time we parked and we walked around, and they showed me every square inch of the track, and what you do and don't do, and the curves you don't hit, and the ones you can run over, and da-da-da-da-da, right. Yeah.
And we should just record for the tape. Obviously, this was pre-chicane.
Yeah, pre-chicane, absolutely, yeah. So monster speed.
Yeah.
So they talked about the danger. They talked about what happens when you get used to the speed and you can misjudge some of the overtaking things. And I was lapping it all up because, I desperately wanted to do well in the race. But then Jan took us into the motorhome, a caravan. It's more like a little caravan, actually. And he sat the two of us down and he said, right, guys, we're going to lose this race. We're definitely going to lose the race. And we're going to lose the race because the gearbox is going to break. That's it.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, well, that's not good. And after a long pause, he said, okay, so if you don't want to lose the race, this is what we've got to do. But we need to agree between us we're going to do this, because there was not enough data on any of the cars to know if we were doing as we were told.
There's
no gear position indicator, for example, or anything like that. So we went then around the track again, and he said, okay, so the S's, it used to be really fast S's at the bottom of the hill.
Yeah.
They were third gear.
Yeah.
But if you took it in fourth gear, it's almost exactly the same lap time. Makes almost
and you've got
no difference.
All that torque from that monster motor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's one down and one up less.
Yeah.
And because also after, if you go in third, you get up to high RPM, you shift up to fourth, then you go back to the third for Tetra Rouge, and it's all happening really quickly. That's one. Okay, chicanes. Yeah, you can do them in second gear, it's probably faster, but let's do it in third gear, and let's be really gentle also on and off the power. So go full throttle, yes, but don't just go wham on full throttle as you're going over a curb.
Yeah.
Anything to rattle the drive shafts and the gearbox. And Mulsanne Corner could have been first. We made it in second. You know, the, all the way around we did this. And even the Porsche curves. The Porsche curves, usually you went in a high gear, but you went down in the middle.
Yeah.
No, do it all in fourth gear.
Yeah.
And the time loss will be minuscule.
And over the course of the race, you would have saved thousands of gear changes.
I think I added it up. It was somewhere between 40 and 50 gear changes a lap. And we'd knocked off probably almost a quarter of them.
For
no reason. And then coupled with the on and off the throttle. And so, but the thing is, it's a race. And you've got to, you've got to drive flat out. Because if you don't, somebody's, you know, people who drive flat out are going to brake. But there are going to be some cars that drive flat out that don't brake. And so therefore you lose. So it's not a case of we're going to use this gear, and we're going to waste a lot of time. No, we're going to waste almost no time. I mean, hopefully, certainly half a second or no more. But you have to train yourself to do it because you'll think, oh, I want a lower gear. Don't be sucked into it. So, okay. And I'm thinking, wow, this is going to be, you know, it's going to be quite interesting. But do I know that they're going to do that as well? you really don't know, do you? But you just have to trust. And so we worked together a lot. It was incredible how we did it. And then on the morning of the morning warm-up, which they used to have in those days, Eddie Hinckley was our race engineer. And he'd done a little bit of calculation, and we'd had a chat between us. And he said he thought if we went softer rear springs, we might pick up some speed on the straight, because if you bleed the rake out with speed... Now, on a flat-bottom car, if you go nose up, because you can take off, but a ground effect car's not susceptible to that, no. So we went softer, I'm not quite remember how much, but we went softer on the rear spring, so effectively at VMAX, we were 7 millimetres nose up on the straight. And we suddenly had a bit more speed than any of the other Jags.
Wow.
So it wasn't that we hid it from the other cars, we said, look, that's what we've done, that's what we picked up. But, you know, after the warm-up, it's a bit dangerous to do it just for the race when nobody's tried it. So I think we were the only car that went with that. And then Jan had told us again, Johnny and I were sat there, and he said, listen, because we qualified, well, I don't know, 10, 12, something, because we didn't have a turbo to turn up for qualifying. So we're in the front half. So he said, I'm just going to not take any risk in the beginning. It's a long race, and we'll just keep it all flowing. Everything's fine. No risk, but, you know, keep the speed. And afterwards, at the second lap, he's leading. And Johnny and I are looking at the screen going, well, that's taking it easy. And, like, we don't believe him, you know, but he you know, I was third in the car. So when Jan got out, he said to me, listen, I'm not kidding you. This thing is a rocket ship. We just need to keep it going. And sure enough, we had some great dices with the factory Porsches. And
yeah, I want to talk to you about those in a minute. But also, I'm all right in saying that I know it would do 248 down the straight, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And that you get the change-up light come on in fifth just before the kink.
That's
and
it.
Then you lose a bit of speed just through scrub through the kink, even though you're flat.
50 revs went off.
Yeah, and then you get it back just before you had to brake from all sounds, so you knew exactly. The gearing was perfect.
Yeah, and also the car was geared for 231.
But because of the cross flies.
Yeah, they grow. Yeah. So that's where you get your 248.
So
it's amazing, isn't it?
Do you think you would have won that race if Klaus Ludwig hadn't run the Porsche out of fuel and if it had stayed raining at the end when Stuck was ridiculously quick in that thing, and I think he stayed out on slicks when everybody else came in, and he was.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? And I've had a couple of races where we lost for a particular reason, and you go, well, if that hadn't happened, we'd have won. And what I'd say to that is, if you've got 60 cars in the race, you've only got one who wins. Of the other 59, I bet 80% of them will tell you how they would have won
if only.
You know, and so I mean, we'll never know, but
you won the race.
We won, and that's and it's not every day you win Le Mans. It doesn't do your career any harm at all. But so I think you were referring to the gearbox issue, and so in the middle of the night, so with the five cars that Jaguar are running, one of the cars in the middle of the night with Raoul Bazzale driving had got a gearbox problem and retired on the spot. excuse me. So Jan was talking to him in the night when he got back. I said, okay, what exactly happened? Well, I came out of the corner, there was a little bit of a vibration, and it popped out of gear, out of third, and I went to go, it wouldn't go back in third, it wouldn't go in fourth, I couldn't get it to any gear, and that was it, no more gears. So I was like, oh, okay. So then I think luckily that Jan was in the car at the end, because he had so much mental capacity to think of other things, but he came out of a corner, he got a vibration, it popped out third, He grabbed the lever and put it in fourth and it went in. And he thought, that's it. I can't touch the lever again.
That's it?
Yeah. You know, it might never stay. So he was stuck in fourth. So this was probably in, it was inside the last hour.
Yeah.
The Porsche that was catching us was overheating.
Yeah.
But the gap was staying pretty much the same. I mean, and then when Jan got stuck in fourth, they were catching us, but when you did the calculation, they wouldn't have made it to catch us. Except if they'd have known that we weren't just slowing down just to make sure everything was okay. We're slowing down because we had a gearbox problem. So nothing was said on the radio.
Because they were listening to you.
Yeah, for sure.
You all listened to each other, presumably.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So Jan just said to the guys, they said to him on the radio, like, is everything okay, Jan? Because he was taking longer to lap. Yeah, everything's fine. Oh, I've got a little secret. I'll tell you after the race. And that's what he said to them. So,
and if you're going to get stuck in a gear there, that's the only gear you can be stuck in, isn't it?
I would say, because you'd lose so much if it was third, wouldn't you? Down the straight.
And presume you overheat or whatever. Yeah. Mm. And if it was fifth, you'd never get round Arnage.
No. So fourth was a 200 mile an hour gear, I think. And then fifth was, I guess, a 250 mile an hour gear. So it worked out. And obviously the V12, it would pull from low down. When you went below four, it wasn't happy.
Yeah.
But it would pull. But he just had one splash and dash to go, 25 minutes from the end. So he came in, got the fuel, and then he basically left the pits with a 200 mile an hour gear, slipping the clutch like crazy. But again, because the engine's quite smooth at the bottom.
So did he get lift the clutch while it's still on the jacks and drop it, or did he?
Did he set off in fourth? Yeah, he just set off in fourth. Because if you did that. Because I know you can do that if you've not got a clutch or whatever, but if it's in a high enough gear, I think when it lands, it would stall it, wouldn't it?
Probably.
I mean, it would say so. I think they did put some water under the wheels from memory, try and help it. But he managed to get it out and keep going. And the margin of victory at the end was 92 seconds. So that last 25 minutes, but 25 minutes is not that many laps. So it was kind of okay. But what did happen was, on the last racing lap, so it's still a race, all the marshals are now on the very edge of the track, waving all the flags like they used to, and cars are still doing well over 200 miles an hour. And if anybody had a tyre failure or anything. And then the other two Jags that were fourth and 16th, the two other ones that were left, were then lined up. We tried to do a lineup for what looks like a photo finish.
Yeah.
But Jan was telling them on the radio, get those guys away from me because I'm stuck. You know, I don't want to have any problems. I have to do my own thing to keep the speed up. I don't want anybody in the way. They were lined up just in case. If the gearbox broke coming out of the last corner, I mean, in the kerfuffle, you could have shoved it across the line. So
they would literally have just nudged it.
I'm sure they would have done, because you know you can make it look like it
was. This is what the ACO thought of that.
Yeah, well, you'd have to do it pretty well.
But
and then everybody ran onto the track, so I'm not even sure the line was crossed in the end because nobody could go. But so that was it. And so when they got the car back to the factory, so you got the main shaft and the lay shaft.
Yeah.
The main shaft was actually broken all the way through, and it was held together in the middle of fourth gear. So
fourth gear was literally all that's holding the gearbox.
Yeah, and it just in the bottom. So then reverse back to the conversation before, we're going to lose this race because the gearbox is going to break.
Yeah.
Then, with all the things we'd done, and we all stuck to what we were told to do.
Yeah.
And being careful, I mean, anything. One throttle on over a curb with half a wheel spin. We were running a spool again. We always ran a spool at Le Mans and Daytona because if you broke a drive shaft, you could get back.
Yes, of course.
And you couldn't with the diffs we were running. It can put a lot of load in the gearbox and the drivetrain if you're going over a curb with your foot on the throttle. We got to the end. So
you won Le Mans. Okay, let's have another one of your cars.
Right, so what have I done? I've done Golf GTI.
Yeah.
The Cayman, the Porsche Cayman.
Rally 6,
And the TS010.
Yeah, so we want car 4 now.
3, so we want car 4. What would be the next? Oh, I got it. Yep, sorry, yeah. Very obscure car.
Go on.
Probably, again, it was on an Evo shoot.
Yeah.
The Renault Megane R26R.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You probably know this car.
Two seats.
Yep.
Yeah.
Honestly, that car was Mighty, absolutely mighty. And I guess the same people who did all that work are doing the stuff on the Alpine, which is probably why that's so good as well. So yeah. The guys from Renault Sport. Incredible. So we were there on a group test with the cars. So from memory, there was an Aston Martin, and I have to confess, I'm confused to hell with Aston Martin's naming and numbering system. I can't tell them all apart. They're all Aston Martins. It was one of them. Yeah. It was there. Then there was the Lamborghini Gallardo.
Yeah.
It was those time. It was a GT2 Porsche, Nissan GTR, may have been one more, and then the R26R.
This little front-wheel drive hatchback.
Yeah. So we're all chatting before we leave for the first day. There's a basket of keys. Okay, right, so we're all going to take a car and we're going to drive up Mont Ventoux.
Yeah.
We'll meet you at the top. So everybody's like grabbing a key. Last key in the basket, always the Renault key. Who wants a Renault? It's a Renault, you know. So you pull this key out, and oh, God, I got this car. Then you start driving this car. After about, I don't know, 500 metres, you're like, wow, this car's amazing. Absolutely amazing. It's on rails. You turn, it turns. The sound from the engine, it was what, 240 horsepower, I think, four-cylinder turbo. But the rasp from the exhaust, it had the titanium exhaust and everything.
Yeah.
That Trexus front suspension you've got, coming down the hill as well, if you'll be coming down and there'll be a rock face in front of you and you arrive at a million miles an hour down the hill, within the speed limit, obviously.
Obviously.
And braking, and then you almost get there. It's almost like you pick the car, by turning the wheel, you pick the car up, move it around and drop it down in the direction it wants to go. Unbelievable. Everywhere. Absolutely everywhere. It's unbelievable. So then in the evening, and we were all swapping cars, and everybody had the same opinion. Then in the evening, we're going back to the hotel, which is quite a long way away, about half an hour drive. And one evening, it was dark, and I've got the Renault, and behind me I've got all these supercars, all with pretty decent drivers in
there. Yeah.
And then you can look in the mirror, and everybody can stay with you.
Yeah.
Right, if there was a straight bit, they'd catch you up, because you've got power, but everywhere. And you get back to the hotel, and you think, I must be quite good, you know. And you go to bed that night quite happy. You're like, I think I know what I'm doing. Well, the next day, when you're driving one of the other cars back to the hotel, there is no way you could stay with this little R26R.
Amazing, isn't it?
It was incredible. And then you realise, it dawned on you, actually, I'm just the same as everybody else. God's brilliant.
No, I think probably not.
Yeah, but it was really impressive, that. Nissan GTR was also pretty impressive in that. And that was the first iteration of it. And, yeah, I thought that was quite impressive. Very impressive gearbox, too. But yeah, so R26R will be my number four car.
Fantastic.
They're all, not in any order, you understand.
So you went on to have this amazing career in sports. And you did do a Formula One test, though, didn't you? You tested a Benetton?
Yeah, so after Macau, Salnet, who was sponsoring David Hunt, had done a deal with Benetton for a bunch of us to go to Donington Park. Yeah,
yeah,
and test the Benetton. So it's David Hunt, myself, Giovanna Amati, Otto Rensing,
yes,
German guy, myself, may have been one more, I don't remember. So the last race of the year in 86, I believe, was Mexico City.
Right.
And Gerhard Berger had won the race on Pirelli tyres, and part of the reason he won the race was he did the whole race on the same set of tyres.
Right.
So a little bit different from how things are now.
Yes.
So they then bring the car to Donington Park. It's freezing cold. It's like 2 degrees. And we're in the old collecting area that was all covered. And they got these tyres in the oven, but they were the same compound as they'd bought in Mexico City, which was boiling hot.
Yeah.
And so you put the tyres on from the oven. If you're not careful, you do three laps and they cool off and you have to put them back in the oven. It was this difficult to keep them warm.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, it was the BMW four-cylinder, 1.5-litre monster engine, which has four butterflies, one on each cylinder, and then a fifth butterfly in the intake.
Right.
So the throttle, which nobody had told me before I drove it, you press the throttle down and it gets up to a resistance, and that's when it opens this fifth butterfly.
Okay.
Butterfly. So I was driving the car for the first few laps, just on the first bit, thinking, God, that's quite powerful. It's still the most powerful thing I'd driven, to date. So that was probably about 450 horsepower or something. And then I accidentally went over a bump around the back somewhere, pushed past the resistance and got fourth battle. And I just thought, oh my goodness, what's happened? It was so quick. It was incredible.
It was nuts.
Yeah, and you had to shift at 11,000, I remember. And so I kept bumping into the rev limiter, and they brought me in and they said, look, you've got to shift before the rev limiter. I go, I know, that's what I'm trying to do, but you couldn't, because it had lag, and it went, and when it reached 8, split second after 8, it went
11.
Eventually you have to anticipate it, and you're an H pattern gearbox and everything. And I got on quite well, and the last of the people that were there was Emanuele Pirro.
Yeah.
So I forget most things, but I kind of got all these numbers in my head, and I believe so he was the fastest at the test, and he ended up getting the drive eventually, getting a drive with them. But I was only 1 second behind him, having never driven an F1. He may not have driven an F1 before, but he'd done Formula 3000 quite a bit.
Yeah.
So for me, it was a much bigger shock. So I was 1 second behind him, and all the other people were slower than that, and some of them considerably slower than that.
Sure.
Didn't make any mistakes. It was all good, but it was... like, I was really nervous. You know, first time you ever drive an F1 car, it's Donington. I was driving at the end when it was dark, or getting very close to dark, and the titanium skids on the bottom of the car, showering these green sparks.
Yeah.
It was incredible. Yeah. And you wouldn't normally drive in those conditions, but it's F1, you've got to drive. So, so that was great. Then, there was a second day. Yeah, so after we'd all done our lap times, and if I'm trying to think of the lap times, I want to say that Pirro did I can't remember the times there, but I was 1 second behind him. Then they brought in Teo Fabi, who was one of the regular drivers, and then after we'd all driven, they chucked him in the car. He did about half a dozen laps, and he went 3 seconds quicker than all of us.
Oh, okay.
So we're like, right, okay, well, so a bit more learning needed, that's what he's doing.
We must crack on a bit
with cars,
with cars and with your career. So you then went on to have this extraordinary sports car career, a career in racing you thought you'd never have, because you thought that you were going to go down the single seater route, and you had all those wins. Two questions really. Firstly, if you take Le Mans, Sebring and Daytona, people who have won both have said to me that winning 12 hours at Sebring is as hard as 24 hours anywhere else.
That's true.
And they also, guys like Derek Baer will tell you that Daytona is tougher than Le Mans. I don't know whether you concur with that. So I was just thinking, of those three races, which did you enjoy the most and which was the toughest?
I think I agree with Derek that Daytona is, it's physically tougher. It's tougher on the car, and it's tougher on the driver. But where Le Mans is really, really tough is mentally.
Yeah.
With the speed, the speeds are so high. The penalty for getting something wrong is multiplied because of the speed. And there are places on the track where if you catch a car, it's just a horrible experience catching a car in the wrong place.
Yeah.
And you can lose a lot of time. So I think they both have their difficult pieces, parts. I think certainly for people based in Europe, of course, Le Mans is the most important race. So winning that race is something which, like, everybody knows. Yeah. There are still people who don't really recognise Daytona very much, but they should do, because it's a really tough race, and it's a fantastic event. It's so competitive, it's very, very close. You probably, some laps, you're passing 15 cars without any exaggeration in and out, and it is really.
And you get
really
a bigger sort of spread between the fastest and the slowest cars at Daytona, don't you?
You do, and also it used to be the case that you also had a bigger spread on driving experience, let's put it that way. I remember once standing in the signing on queue, and so the guy came to the front, and then so the... then he said, where's your license? Oh, I'm going to get it soon, or something like that. I said, have you got any racing experience? I said, well, no, but I'm a dentist. I remember him saying that. So somehow they managed to do the paperwork, and he did take part in the race. So, so there are these situations. Yeah. But I think by and large, most people are behaving themselves, because it's quite a culture shock on the banking.
Yeah.
It's easily flat on the banking, but because it's pulling and tugging, and in those days no power steering, so it is a little bit weird. The places like the first corner and the bus stop chicane, where you can end up with four or five cars arriving on the same piece, and especially at night, it's not very well lit, and you can't really see where you're going. So I'd say Daytona is tougher. But as you say, Sebring with the bumps, it absolutely pulverizes you.
Yeah.
And the car.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky one to win also.
Wow. I just want to talk about a couple of other things. I mean, largely the more base. Let's talk about 95. When you're in the Harrods McLaren, and again, we're talking about, you know, if only. But, you know, that was a race you were absolutely on schedule to win. Sharing with Derek, sharing with Justin Bell as well. I mean, I remember that I was there. I remember the weather.
Yeah.
I imagine that McLaren was a tricky thing to drive, wasn't it?
Certainly was if your all of your experience and up to that point was in high downforce prototypes.
Yeah.
And then you effectively drive a GT1 car with, it's a bit softer, less downforce, higher off the ground.
I mean, massively less downforce, presumably.
Yeah, massively, yeah.
Yeah.
There was a river running across the track just as you'd put it in top gear after Tetra Rouge. And every single time... there. If you went through with a prototype, it would have just gone straight through. But every time you hit it, the car was like that, and you're in top gear, and you know it's coming, and you have to do it, you know, for 24 hours. It was tricky to drive. But as you say, we were leading the race for, I think we led the race for like 10 hours or something, and we were still leading a couple of hours from the end when we had this clutch issue. And it was not quite as bad as Jan had, but the slow cylinder, which is expanding bobbing in the bell housing, was leaking, and so we couldn't get any clutch pressure at all. So effectively, no clutch. Now it was a synchromesh gearbox. So if it was a normal racing dog box, you'd do it fine without a clutch. But it was very bulky gearbox, and you needed the clutch. So it was, you know, if you rent a car and you're practicing driving without using the clutch, sometimes. You do that.
Yeah, all the time. It's obligatory, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, good. It's not just me then. So you know, you can be in neutral. You can not get a gear, be in neutral. As long as you just go blip, blip, you get it right, you can pop it in any gear.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that with this. So if you got one shot at it, changing without the clutch, and then if it kind of got wrong, you'd be in no man's land, and no amount of blipping would find you a gear. That's just how it was. So we took the decision that the only way to get to the end of the race safely without parking on the side of the road would be to just use fifth and sixth, because it's in one gate and you can be sure.
Yeah.
If you try to get one across the gate and miss it, they're done. So we did the rest of the last 2 hours with just fifth and sixth. So it was quite a while before the next one caught us, and then we went down to second, and then it was quite close to the end when we lost the lead. So we finished.
And what was it like, you know, given that, you'll hate me for saying this, but he was quite a senior driver even at the time, just sharing with Derek, he must have been 53, 54.
I think it was 53,
yeah.
He
was 53, and this absolute Le Mans legend. Did he live up to expectations?
It's absolutely amazing guy, and I'd already shared a car with him at Daytona. It was a Spice Chevy, I think it was. And that was interesting. What I found was he was driving the car in one of the sessions at Daytona, and then I drove it after him, and I thought, this car's really not very well set up. But Derek had got out, and he thought it was okay, and he was doing reasonable lap times. So I got in, and I said, Derek, this is horrible. And he said, well, do what you want with it. So changed a few things and made it really nice.
Yeah.
And then he drove it after me, and he said, oh, yeah, no, it's lovely, it's great. So at that point, I thought to myself, hang on, you've won all those races and had such a successful career, and actually you're not as good at setting the car up as I imagined you would be.
Yeah.
So at that point I realised just what an amazing talent Derek was. I bet you could put him in any car, set up well or badly, and he could still drag a time out of it.
But someone like me, Ronnie Peterson was like that.
Was he also?
They deliberately make a car rubbish.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't notice. He'd come in and they'd say, oh, you know, what's the car doing now? And he'd go, might be oversteering a bit more, sure. And they put insane setup on it.
Right.
And he just got into it. He had such enormous natural talent. He would just get into and fling about whatever he was in. He didn't think too hard about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's it then. That's exactly what Derek was. I mean, massively talented guy.
Yeah.
And could drive anything in any condition. So he was 53, you're right. And at the time, It was 95, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 95.
Yeah, so I was 34.
Yeah.
A good bit younger than him. So at this point, I didn't know what it was to be 53.
Yeah.
I do now. and sure enough, the performance that Derek put in for somebody who's 53 was absolutely outstanding.
Fantastic. You
know, horrible conditions. And what I did notice with him, everything was all going really nicely. But then once it looked like we really did have a chance of getting a result, he clicked up a gear. He really did. So you can see world champion in him.
Yeah.
There. And it was very unfair for Justin, because a couple of times he got put in the car and it was dark and it was pouring with rain, and you know, and he was the junior in this, and it's just a horrible situation. So you know,
yeah, there were sort of unflattering comparisons to his pace relative to JJ's and the car that won it. And
but he didn't, you know, he didn't bin the car. No. So if he'd have bin the car, it was all gone. So you can't say anything about it against him either.
And, absolutely.
So it was nice, but I did quite a number of hours in the car, I remember.
More than your fair share, perhaps?
Well, I was so exhausted at the end, and then we had to go to the press conference afterwards. And I honestly, I couldn't keep my eyes open. I was actually quite grumpy as well, because I was so tired. I just wanted everybody to leave me alone. And of course they won't. They're asking all these questions.
Yeah.
One of the questions was, they said to me something like, "Oh, it must have been really fantastic to drive with Derek and Justin." And I could just feel myself, my mouth was going to open and I was going to say something really bad. And usually I can't catch it. It comes out. I just, there. But I managed to put my arm down my throat and stop myself saying it. Not that I would have said anything bad, but it was just like, everything was like all about driving with Derek.
Yeah.
And that's... Well, it wasn't like that. Now, and I should qualify this, and definitely this needs to be played, is I rate Derek incredibly highly.
Yeah.
And then when I wasn't doing sports cars, when I was still doing this, I was looking up to Derek and Jackie Hicks and these guys, and they're unbelievable, unbelievable drivers. And also, what he did at age 53 in that race in Le Mans in 95, pouring rain, in a car that wasn't easy to drive, was absolutely outstanding, and I absolutely guarantee you I could get nowhere near him if we were the same age. Brilliant guy.
Fantastic.
But,
let's have your fifth car.
So the fifth car, right, so now I am going to choose a Bugatti.
Good. I hoped you would.
Yeah, and so as you know, we did 304.7724 miles an hour in this car. In general, when I retire from racing, so I've been with Bugatti for just over 11 years now.
Yeah.
All of my racing career, as you're going along, racing cars were really, really powerful, and road cars were not.
Yes.
And somewhere along the line, I kind of hadn't concentrated on what was going on in the real world. And every time racing cars got too fast, the regulators tried to slow them down, took power away, air restrictors, and with less and less and less power, racing cars were still lapping faster and faster and faster.
Yeah.
So, fast forward a little bit, and Butch Leitzinger, who I won Daytona with twice, and we were on the podium with the Bentley in Le Mans. He was a test driver for Bugatti in the US, and so eventually they were looking for an extra driver. So he took me for a ride in the Supersport Veyron at the time, so 1,200 horsepower. And then I drove it afterwards. And I was just blown away
at
how fast a road car could be. I had no idea they could be this fast. It's incredible. And having the traction as well, because a racing car is limited by the traction in the lower gears. And then in the higher gears, it's got a lot of drag. So eventually that's going to blunt it a bit. And then you fast forward to the Chiron, which initially was 1,500 horsepower and then 1,600 newton meters with no wheel spin, even in first gear, once you've got tire temperature. So this acceleration is incredible. Now, there are people who say, oh yeah, but it can't be a great car because it weighs 2 tons and you've driven it and you kind of know. But that kind of, for me, that's beside the point. The issue with cars, which are sort of track-focused cars, but they're road cars, they are exactly that. They're compromised as road cars because they're designed, you know, to try and give you some thrill on the track.
Yeah.
But if you take any racing car and put it on the track, it'll easily beat any of these pretend racing cars.
Yeah.
So I don't care for that bit in the middle, really.
And the one thing about assurance is not the last thing it's trying to be is a track car.
Exactly, yeah. It's not a track car, but it's top luxury, it's incredibly fast, it's really, really safe and stable, and it's a real joy to drive at any speed, 20 miles an hour in a traffic jam, or going fast. So then eventually comes the Supersport and the Supersport 300 Plus, which is going to be my car.
Yeah.
So that's the one we did the, or the prototype of that, we did the 304 miles an hour. And I just think it's an amazing piece of engineering. And at the same time, you can go to Tesco's in it.
I mean, when I came out, I'm not going to spend long talking about me because that's not what this podcast is for, but when I came out to see you at Molsheim and we drove the car, I was almost as impressed just looking at the cars in the factory and just looking at the attention to detail and the quality of the engineering as I was by the actual driving experience. Because the quality, the total dedication goes down to the smallest component in parts of the car that you never normally see. And it is, it is a proper job, isn't it?
Properly engineered from the beginning, and it's also designed to last. I mean, the reason it's the engine and gearbox is 650 kilos. That's a third of the weight of the car, and if you add the fluids, it's almost half the weight of the car. So why is that? You could get that power from the V8, but that misses the point. This is a durable engine. Yeah. It's only 100 horsepower per cylinder. It's designed to do 200,000 miles without any major service. So, you know, that's why it's like that. It's durable, and it's. We have people who drive the cars every day, and we have people who don't drive them very much at all. But you know, it's designed to be used, and it's kind of bulletproof. So it has to be in my list of cars. And if you get a nice bit of road, it doesn't have to be a straight piece. If it's a straight piece, that's nice too. But if you can get some twisty bits, the steering feels amazing for a car that weighs 2 tons.
Yeah,
as you well know. So
we're going to need to wrap it up. Fairly shortly, but you went on, you had this amazing career. You did Le Mans 20 times?
21. Yeah.
21 times. You probably know how many Daytonas and Sebrings I don't, I'm afraid.
I think it was 21 Daytonas as well, and I think 19 Sebrings.
Mm. Wow, so that's quite a lot, that's over 60 top level of the three greatest sports car races that there are. Mm. No regrets, presumably.
I mean, if you knew later on in your career, earlier, you maybe could have made some different decisions, but.
But do you think that as a person you are, I'm not talking about driving talent or anything else because you've proven yourself, but just as a person you are more in your character disposed to being a sports car driver because of the teamwork that's required and, you know, because to be a Formula One driver, you probably have to be pretty selfish and it's all about you. And did you find that process of working with other drivers who became your friends, did you find that suited you in a way that you wouldn't have imagined when you were sitting there as a young lad trying to get into Formula One?
Definitely. And also you've got a much longer career if you do sports car racing. So you can get to 50 and still just about be able to drive for a factory team.
So
from that side, it's good. So I didn't get to Formula One because I couldn't find the money, but I also am a pretty firm believer that if you were good enough, somehow something would have happened. So I don't think I didn't do Formula One because I didn't have the money. I think I obviously wasn't. We're talking about there's a very few people in the world who are that good, and I'm sure I wasn't one of them.
But if you do have the money, you can get there even if you're not that good. We have seen, you know, Mazepins and you know, examples of that happening. So
yeah, but that's if you just want to be a Formula One driver, just to have the label.
Sure.
And it probably doesn't do your career any harm to have been a Formula One driver. But I'm just sort of talking about, you know, kind of making it. You have to take a lot of money to go to Formula One if you don't come with a massive reputation. Even if you do,
sure,
you probably still need the money. But I just kind of think that just to say, well, I would have been a Formula One driver, but I didn't have the money, is probably. It's not something I even think about. I only talk about it. You ask the question. So I think I never was going to be good enough to do that. But I got to drive some amazing cars, work with some great teams and drivers and stuff. And God, some of the races that we had, I mean, some of the memories. Incredible.
Who was not the best in terms of the biggest talent? Which driver did you most enjoy driving with?
I think it has to be James Weaver, to be honest. Yeah. And then the third part of that wheel was always Butch Leitzinger. So the three of us would do the long races together.
Yeah.
And that was amazing because we're different people completely, but we were all knowing that we had to pull together, mostly with Dyson Racing.
Yes.
We were doing this. And so James was an absolute whiz with shock absorbers and things. So we had a shock dyno in the truck. So he quite often had shock oil dripping down his arms, and he was doing that. I used to look after the springs and the aero stuff, and Butch would be in the motorhome reading the newspaper. And I remember this happened on a lot of tracks. And then at Road Atlanta, I believe the time was 1:10:07, something like that. So James had done a 1:10:07. And then this was in the morning warm-up after all the sessions. And I jumped in, I did a 10:07, and we got Butch away from his newspaper. Butch, here, we've got the car set up, mate. It'll be fine for you. He jumps in, half a dozen laps, 1:10:07. And all three of us had exactly the same lap time in the morning warm-up for the start of the race at Petit Le Mans 1 year.
Yeah.
And he'd go, well, if you look down the grid, there are very few teams that all three drivers are the same.
Yeah.
So Butch was brilliant because if you've got three of you trying to do it, you all get less laps. But if he's happy reading the newspaper,
yeah,
and when you plug him in, yeah, he's good to go.
But they're both also both really good blokes, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Great guys to hang out with.
Yeah, yeah, really, really fantastic.
Okay, so give us your final car.
So the final car is a bit left field, and people listen to this who are proper petrol heads and all the rest of it. At this point, they're going to throw bread rolls at the whatever they're listening to this on. Yeah. Swerving across the road, spitting and all these things. But I'm sorry, it's an electric car.
Fair enough.
And you might have seen as you walked in through the front door,
yeah,
I've got two electric cars and I absolutely love them, which doesn't mean I don't like petrol cars.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. But I and everybody else knows it's going to go away from pure combustion cars. Now, whichever way, whichever direction it goes, I think we don't need to worry. I really don't. Because you can sit there and go, oh, but I like these cars and I want the V12 and I want this and I want that and it's not going to be the same. Yeah, but hang on a second. I have been in such a lucky position to have driven some things in the future.
Yeah.
And it's not a horrible place at all.
Great.
So it will be... I shouldn't say too many things about the Bugatti side, but when the next Bugatti comes out after Chiron, it will be something which will blow you away. Absolutely blow you away. So nothing to worry about there.
Okay.
We'll have gone up a massive notch. So the car that I'm going to throw into this is the Rimac Nevera.
Yeah.
So this is, and you'll be well aware that Rimac now own 55% of Bugatti.
Yeah.
In conjunction with Porsche. And they are world leaders in the electric motors, inverters, batteries, everything.
Sure.
So their car that they've built, I've only driven the prototype version of it, but I've driven it on the road in Croatia, I've driven it on the road in Italy and on the track. And quite a lot of mileage in the car now.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that at the moment for somebody who's got the money to buy a hypercar, it might be a bit of a step too far to go immediately to an electric car. But from the driving side of it, and I'm not necessarily talking about, it's a very hard act to follow the Chiron because it's so refined and it's a complete car. The drivetrain on the Nevera is absolutely out of this world. It's beyond anybody's comprehension. I mean, you probably
drive. I haven't driven it, no.
You're going to one day,
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure I will. Well, I hope I will.
So why do I say that? So obviously it's very powerful.
Yeah.
This is a given, but much more than that. So try not to make this long, but when we went from turbocharged Group C to the 3.5 litre formula, the one thing I noticed was how razor sharp the throttle response was on the 3.5 litre.
Yeah.
But when we were driving the turbo cars, we had 900 horsepower or 1100 in qualifying. We never complained about the throttle response. We just said, wow, this thing's really powerful.
Yeah.
And left it at that. So now you fast forward to where we are with the Nevera. So the throttle response is whatever you want it to be.
Of course.
It doesn't have to be so razor sharp you can't drive it, but you move your ankle and you get what you ask for.
Yeah.
On top of that, because it's got four electric motors and they're all controlled by central computers, so it can give the maximum amount of torque to each wheel when you ask for it. On any given surface, bumpy, and there's a lot of bumpy roads in Italy, bumpy with potholes and all this, it will give the car, each wheel, the exact amount that it can put down, and it's reappraising that like every millisecond.
Yeah.
So it will always have the most amount that you can put down on the road,
yeah,
and it can instantly stop the wheel spin and then give more power back again. So the control of that is incredible. So if you then go on a smooth surface with the two cars, we had lots of cars together, all very impressive. You then go to a bumpier place and the Nevera doesn't lose anything. It still goes and it goes like crazy. It's not tugging or pulling. It is just quite addictive, actually. I think if you're in the passenger seat the first time, I've never been in the passenger seat. I've only ever driven it, but I've taken passengers, and the reaction you get is just like, it's amazing. Great. So it's really fantastic. And then, you know, things like the regen too. It's I think it's 300 kilowatts of regen, so 400 horsepower.
Yeah,
just lifting off. And so I'm just thinking in terms of I've been with Bugatti for 11 years. The car is amazing. It's so refined. It's so fantastic. So, but the future, it's going to have to go away from that eventually. I mean, yeah, we might be a number of years ahead, but I know that in collaboration with Remats, the next Bugatti will be something amazing. So I got to put the Nevera in, because I can't, you know, when each time I've driven it, I've not been able to stop talking about it. And I will again say that, of course, there is nothing that can match the level of quality of the Bugatti. That's not what I'm saying. But the job that those guys have done is outstanding. It's absolutely outstanding.
Mega. Right. So here we go. Crunch time. You have to tell me, of those six cars, which you would take for your last drive, whether you'd be in it on your own or if you would be with someone, who that person would be and where you'd drive it.
Right. I might actually be in the car on my own, because I spend quite a lot of time in cars with people.
Fair enough. What you do, don't you? Yes.
Yeah. And some of the scariest times I've ever had in a car have been with people.
Yeah.
So, I tend to be a bit jittery sometimes in the passenger seat. I've done, this might be a bit predictable, but I've done a lot of pretty long trips in a Chiron over several days.
Yeah.
On twisty roads and long roads and straight roads and autobahn, and I've never ever got out of the car at the end of the day without having an amazing time.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to have to be that. But this is a crazy question, because of course what we're doing is we're blowing all financial considerations out of the water.
But that's the joy, isn't it?
Yeah.
There are no rules. Okay. So it's a Chiron. You're on your own. You still got to tell me where.
There are some amazing roads between France and or Switzerland and Italy. All those twisty roads and the tunnels and the views and everything.
There you go. That's good enough.
Brilliant.
Andy Wallace, thank you so much for taking part in the TI Last Blast podcast.
Absolute pleasure.
Brilliant.